The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
The BS Report.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. Pleased to have the author of the Saturday Night Live book. What's that called? Live from Saturday Night?
Live from New York.
Live from New York. Notice how prepared I am. As well as the ESPN book, Those Guys Have All the Fun. These Guys Have All the Fun?
Those guys have all the fun.
Yeah, I probably should have written this stuff down.
The Ten Commandments, not the 11 Commandments.
Jim Miller, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
You were supposed to come on in September, but fate intervened, and now you're coming on about a month after the paperback of the SNL book came out, which I thoroughly enjoyed, which had, I think, over 200 pages of new stuff. You last wrote that book, I think it came out in 2004, 2005, so you basically missed the whole, I guess you would say, the Kristen Wiig hater Sudeikis era was not represented.
And the digital era, too, although it came out in hardback. We decided to go full force.
Right. So did you take anything out of the hardcover and add stuff, or was it all just added new stuff?
I mean, there may have been just a couple little tiny tweaks here and there. Didn't want it to be like a 900-page book, but basically it's over 200 new pages.
And the most interesting, I guess, development over the last 10 years was how the show evolved digitally and the digital shorts and all that stuff, which, you know, I'm not positive Sandberg gets enough credit for, just in a big picture sense, for just the breath of fresh air that breathed into the show. And, you know, the show from 03, 04, 05, I thought was in a little bit of a funk, didn't totally know what it was. It was between the Will Ferrell era and some new era that hadn't evolved yet. And the combination of the Sandberg videos and YouTube, don't you think that was probably the biggest thing that happened last decade?
Absolutely. And I think you got to credit Akiva and Yorma as well. But, yep. You know, the funny thing is, it was just an accident. You know, I spent a lot of time in the new book deconstructing that. And the truth is that those guys just didn't like pitching. And so for them, it was easier just to go out and shoot something and then show it to everybody and say, do you like this? And, you know, right. That one small little fact about SNL, about how difficult it is to pitch ideas to the room, basically created, you know, a whole new era for the show.
And then you also had, they just struck oil with a couple cast members. I think, you know, Hader, Kristen Wiig, Poehler, who left at the end of last decade, but just, you know, real stars that you've always felt like when you were watching the show, were going to go on to bigger and better things. Now I'm watching this year's show, and I'm not sure who those people are on this show that will transcend the show. Do you see, like, if you had to bet on three people, who would you bet on?
Well, Kate McKinnon is definitely worth a bet, although I will say I miss her this season. I felt like last season,
I mean, when did she come back?
I mean, she was roaring ahead, and obviously every week is, you know, I mean, there's no guarantees, but I felt like last year she was a much bigger blip on the SNL radar screen than she is this year, and it's probably no fault to her own, of hers, but, you know, just the way the show sorts itself out. So I would probably bet on, Kate being around. I think Kenan Thompson's going to have an interesting career after SNL. Guessing this is probably his last year. And, you know, he still pops when he's on the show. And I think that there'll probably be some fun things for him. But I guess the big X factor is Pete Davidson, because I do think he's off to a strong start, although he's much better on Update than he is in the sketches, because his eyes are kind of like wandering around when he's in the sketches. And I know that takes getting used to, but once he settles down, I think he's going to be a real find.
He's definitely out of all the people they have. He's the one guy who jumps off the TV, which I think is a great way to judge the SNL people. Like if you just can't take your eyes off them in a sketch, like he, in the Jim Carrey episode, he played Jim Carrey's zombie son is with Jim Carrey. And it was just like, as a combo, I was kind of riveted the whole time. It wasn't the best sketch, but I thought they were good at it. I thought the Carrey show was fascinating though, because it took them almost 75 minutes to put him and Kate McKinnon in a sketch, which I would have thought going into the show, that would have been the number one goal of the show, was to be like, how can we unleash these two in the same sketch? I don't totally understand that show sometimes. Like when you're watching that, are you just, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, you're probably the show's number one historian. Do you just scratch your head sometimes at some of that stuff?
Sometimes, but you know, it's interesting because I like going to dress. I don't really like going to the live show. I like going to dress, and then it's kind of like a parlor game afterwards. You know, you pick which sketches you think are going to survive, and then I even do the order, kind of like this is what, you know, in a fantasy world I would be putting on in the order. And you know, to Lauren's credit, there's a whole other thing he's thinking about. So he operates on a different level, and sometimes, you know, it's easy to understand, and sometimes it's not. But I don't think they strategize in the way that you were just talking about. Like, okay, let's get Carey and let's get McKinnon right off early. It's more, it winds up being this really weird meritocracy, which is just like, what do we think the best sketches are? And they go from there.
So that's not a question of like a rhythm type thing where it's like, we'll put the best sketch first and then here's a sketch that just kind of goes in a different direction, but now we know we have the second best sketch after that. They don't think that way.
Well, I think that, look, the strongest material, the cold open is always going to be important because you got to get off to a flying start. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of attention paid to that. But, you know, in the old days, I remember when Update was earlier, you'd have, you know, a really great sketch right before because you wanted to hold people, you know, for Update. And now, of course, it's after the musical act and a little bit later. Sometimes it's a lot later, but it's kind of settled down now in its own place.
So the bulk of your paperback was about this new era that kind of it unfolded. Do you feel like, I mean, basically you could break the show down into a bunch of different eras, right? The first era was the first 5 years, the Belushi, Aykroyd, Bill Murray, Lorne Michaels era. Then it goes to the Eddie Murphy, Ebersol era. Then it goes to eventually the Phil Hartman, kind of blossoms into the Phil Hartman, Dana Carvey, but then Mike Myers, Adam Sandler, kind of goes all the way through to the disastrous Garofalo season. Now all of a sudden you have the Will Ferrell era. Then you have another transition, and now all of a sudden you're in the Polar, Hater, Kristen Wiig, that era.
The Tina Fey, and don't forget Tina
Fey. Yeah, which was
both behind the scenes and in front of the camera. She was a pretty big mouth of all.
Right. And now we're in this kind of undefined era, and it's year two. Usually when they have the transition years, it's 1 year, but then things kind of work itself out in the second year. This is the second year, and it still feels like a transition to me. Am I wrong?
It is a transition, and in part because, I mean, look, they not only lost Hader, they lost Will Forte, they lost Kristen. Andy, there was a lot of losses at the same time, or at least within, you know, a couple of years, and it takes time to recover. I mean, I think one of the things that's going on right now is you just don't have that big alpha like you do with Will Ferrell or Phil Hartman. I mean, to a certain degree, you know, Hader became that guy, and yet Will Forte and Jason Sudeikis, and I mean, there was a lot of bench strength. There's a lot of talent on the cast right now. It's just that there's not somebody that can carry the show. There's not somebody that can, I mean, one of the great things about Will Ferrell and of course Eddie Murphy is that they could take average material and make it great. Right. And no matter, you know, what they were doing, that sometimes they could read the yellow pages and you would just be so consumed by them and their presence on the show. And, you know, right now they probably, you know, don't have that person, which means that it's a little tougher. It's a little tougher. And, you know, and Update is going through a huge transition.
Yes. I want to talk about that in a second. I thought SNL over, you know, I've been there for most of the 40 years. I started watching in the late 70s at some point. It's a lot like a basketball team. And you're not going to win a title in basketball unless you have the alpha dog. And I think any great SNL season, you always knew who the alpha dog was. And when it's a season where it's just role players, that's almost like where you have an NBA team that doesn't have the great scorer or the great big man. And it's just a bunch of guys who are solid, but ultimately they aren't going to be that threatening. I wonder, it's almost like lightning in a bottle to find somebody like that, right? And you need to be smart with who you're getting. You also need to get that person at the right time in their career when they're kind of ready to blossom, when they're ready for it. And I mean, don't you think that's at least like 50, 60% just luck, just to catch somebody at that point? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And also it's also sometimes the marriage of the right cast member with the right writing staff.
Yeah.
You know, because there have been, just like we're talking about the pluses and minuses on the acting side, there are, you know, some great writers that come through and then all of a sudden they disappear. I mean, John Mulaney, you know, was there, and Jim Downey was there, and Paul Appel was there all the time. I mean, you know, those people are difficult to replace as well. So, but I think to your point about the basketball team, look, you know, not every season is a championship season. And so when you do go through, you know, it's like your Celtics losing McHale and Bird, and, you know, I mean, right. All of a sudden you lose them, and where are you going to find the replacements?
Right. And when they had that disastrous Garofalo season, they fired Sandler and they fired Farley, which I don't think a lot of people even realize. You covered that in your book, but it seems like I think people
Sandler
now
didn't even realize it.
Right. They just got pushed off the show. But, you know, then Lauren kind of rededicated himself that summer to finding new talent and ends up with Farrell and a bunch of other people and some new writers. And then the Adam McKay era starts, and you still have Smigel there and all these people. And all of a sudden now you're winning 55 games again.
Well, you know, one of the weird things also is that just this idea that sometimes great talent doesn't necessarily translate to the show. I mean, we were just talking about Sandler. I mean, Don Allmire, who was running NBC Entertainment at the time, you know, literally wanted Sandler off the show. Didn't think he was funny. Didn't think Norm MacDonald was funny. You know, so, I mean, Chris Rock is probably, people who watched Chris Rock on Saturday Night Live, I mean, he's hosting this week, but people who watched him on Saturday Night Live probably didn't get an idea of just how brilliant he was, because, you know, he was like a Porsche going 40 on the show. That wasn't necessarily his fault or the writer's staff. It just wasn't that perfect, you know, combination like it was for somebody like Hader.
Right. And also, he wasn't that good on the show. I mean, he had moments, but ultimately, by the time he left, like, he jumped to In Living Color, and it wasn't even that big of a deal. It wasn't like, oh my God, Chris Rock left. I mean, I feel like that, if anything, that show probably caught Chris Rock at the wrong point in his career.
Right.
I don't think he really evolved into Chris Rock yet. And you know, you look at somebody like Pete Davidson now, what is he? He's 20, right? He's 20 years old.
Yep.
So who knows? It's going to be tough. You mentioned Update. I would say Update is in probably the worst shape it's been in since the Colin Quinn era. I was not a Colin Quinn Update fan. Especially coming off the heels of, you had Fallon and you had Tina Fey, who, when you look back, it's kind of incredible that they were the 2 weekend Update hosts, because they've had so much success since. Then you had Tina Fey and Poehler. Then you had Tina Fey, Poehler and Seth.
Seth and Amy.
Yeah, then you had Seth by himself. I mean, all of those people have gone on to much bigger and better things. And now it's like, you know, Colin Jost and Michael Che, who I actually think Michael Che has a lot of potential, but as a combo, I just don't see the chemistry. What do you think so far?
Well, the weird thing was that they had a lot of chemistry in the writer's room, so it wasn't like they didn't know each other. But I think one of the things that we're seeing this season just is a reminder of, you know, how incredibly lucky we were earlier, as you said, if you look down at those last 10 years, to have those combinations on the Update desk, that was pretty impressive. And I also think Seth is one of those guys that we kind of almost, we didn't take him for granted, but when you think about the job that he did, given what happened with Cicely and Colin, and now Colin and Michael Che, you know, it is really, Seth was really impressive. And one of the ways he was impressive, and the guys now are just trying to figure this out, but when people came on the Weekend Update set, like, the whole thing with Stefan, I mean, Seth took that to another level. His
right.
dynamic with people who came on was incredible, because he just elevated them. And it's a really hard thing to do. And, you know, when Hader came back to host, he went on the Update set, and, you know, I mean, he was good, and, you know, it was fine. We expected it, and it was a lot of fun to see him doing it. But that dynamic that, you know, he had with Seth is kind of like irreplaceable. It's what Seth did on Weekend Update was very, very hard to do.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it's a real talent to be able to do that. And I would say, I'd use a professional wrestling term. In wrestling, the best wrestlers are the guys who sell the other guys. You know, and you go through history, and it's like Shawn Michaels and Ric Flair and John Cena. It's it's not just that they're good at wrestling, but they're also selling the other guy's moves and they're great at it. And when the other guy does a move, the way you fall and the way you pretend you're hurt and all that stuff is such a big part of the match. Seth was, I thought, fantastic at that. And you really felt the difference with Hayter when he came back versus how he played off of him. And I actually think that might be Seth's best talent, or one of his top two or three best talents, is the way he plays off other people. And I watch his show now, and I think that's the one thing that's kind of missing. Seth's at his best when he's surrounded by characters and chaos, and he's kind of the straight man for it and selling it. And I don't know how you make that a focal point of a late night show, but I really think that's what his best quality is. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And by the way, he did that as head writer as well. I mean, Seth is, in terms of like ego and paranoia, he's pretty low on the scale on both. And he was just this, he had this infectious enthusiasm for other people's work. And you saw it on the Weekend Update desk when guests came on, because he wanted to elevate them. But you also saw it with other, you know, people and material and stuff. I mean, when I interviewed him for this recent book, he was telling me about the process they had during 2008, you know, the great presidential campaign year with Palin and Obama and everybody. And, you know, I mean, there's just no ownership in his world. I mean, he would go around asking everybody, can you make this better? What do you think about this? I mean, there's no silos. It was just this one big ecosystem. And I think that that's pretty rare.
Yeah, when I did PTI with Kornheiser, and I didn't know what I was doing. I was scared, you know, trying to read a teleprompter and all that stuff. And he sold the crap out of me for 4 days, you know. And I think that's – I don't think Tony gets enough credit as a broadcaster for how good he is at selling other people. And you could throw anybody on PTI and Wilbon's spot, and Kornheiser, and whether they're going to be good, bad, mediocre, or whatever – Kornheiser is still going to sell the hell out of them. And it's a real skill. And it's something that, like, just the more TV I do, I really want to get better at that. Because if you're not selling the people that's around you, the audience can feel it. And, you know, if you're making a joke and there's just dead silence and stuff like that, like, the audience can feel it. And it's a skill. And I think to have Seth next to Hayter for those Stefans, what did they film, like 16 of those? Yeah. They don't work as well if he's not selling the Stefan like he did. It was just great. I don't know what the future is for Colin Jost and Che. If anything, like, if I had to bet, I would bet that eventually they just give it to Che by himself. No inside info, nothing. I just think that's kind of the destiny. That there is something compelling about him. And maybe it's just, maybe that's a solo job. I don't know. What do you think?
He doesn't look physically comfortable yet. And I think that once he becomes more physically comfortable, I think that they might, as a, you know, as a team, maybe get a level up. But remember, Colin had his time with Sicily as well, so this is his second go around. But, you know, it takes sometimes it takes a while to get used to.
Right. TV's really hard. It's hard. The hardest thing to do is that last step of just trying to seem like you're comfortable all the time. And
well, the other thing about SNL in general, and this, you know, a lot of cast members mentioned this to me during interviews and stuff, is just the expectations are so sky high. I mean, you're talking about 39 years, you know, 39-year legacy. And so there's a lot of expectations, and particularly an update. When you're going to go there and you're going to sit in the chair that Chevy Chase and Billy Murray and, you know, I mean, all those people sat in, you know, it's the deep end of the pool. You gotta be ready for people to think that you're going to, you know, you can't hit singles and doubles. Sorry to mix metaphors there, swimming and baseball, but you really have to come through. And if you don't, they get ticked off. I mean, I've done a couple of call-in shows recently about SNL, and, you know, people get upset if they don't think it's at the level that they should be.
Do we know why Bill Murray did not host the first show this season? Because people thought that was going to happen.
Yeah, I think it's safe to assume that he said no, because otherwise there's nobody in the world that would, you know, say to Bill, oh no, you can't do it. Or, you know, and St. Vincent's was out. I was really hoping for it. I mean, I know a lot of people were, but it was
happening at some point. Like, I mean, everybody, I know, like, by in late August, everybody around the show thought Bill Murray was going to be the host. So
that was the hope. I was told, I mean, I don't know if this is true or not, but, you know, at the end of the day, Bill just changed his mind, and which is a shame, because that would be that would have been incredible.
It's interesting that, I mean, wouldn't you say Well, Eddie's still alive, I guess. It feels like Bill Murray is kind of like Willie Mays right now. Like Willie Mays, you'd be like, oh, there's the greatest living baseball player, right? So Bill Murray, I would say, is the greatest living SNL cast member, even though I don't think he was the best cast member. Him and Aykroyd are the ties to that first era, you know, which was the most important era in the history of the show. But I think he's aged as a celebrity better than Aykroyd has for a variety of reasons. Don't you think?
Well, he's the best from that era, but I still think Will is thankfully alive and well. And, you know, Will was probably important to the show than Bill.
Well, so is Eddie. I'm just saying, yeah. Like, but Murray's attached to that first era, which that era is always going to be the most important. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. If those 5 years aren't the way that they were, then we're not talking about it 39 years later, 40 years later. I thought the Grandland list was pretty good, although I got carsick when I saw Rob Schneider over Jan Hooks and Terry over Anna Gasteyer. I thought those were my two big quibbles.
There was a couple tough ones. Jan Hooks obviously got the late Jan Hooks now, sadly, but she got robbed. And I thought the Final Four ended up in a pretty good spot. And if it wasn't Will Ferrell versus Eddie, then we did something wrong. I don't even remember who the finals were, but Will Ferrell. Was it Will Ferrell versus Hartman?
Yeah.
I think that's what it was.
And then Hader was on the final brackets as well. But, I mean, the thing about Eddie is it's kind of like we're conflating two different worlds because Eddie saved the franchise and Will was probably, day in and day out the better one. But without Eddie, I don't think the show survived.
I mean... Those are two of my favorites. Eddie is one of my formative guys that I just don't feel like I'd be doing this for a living in any capacity if it wasn't for him and Letterman and a couple other people. But I thought Eddie was the best cast member in the history of the show. He's the only person that always felt like he was bigger than the show. Like it almost felt like every show he did, it almost was like unbelievable that this guy was on the show. You know what I mean? It was like, how do they still have him? Just... You should be doing multi-million-dollar movies right now. From the moment he took off, he seemed like he transcended the show. Ferrell got there. Yeah, at 19, 20 years old. Ferrell got there in a lot of ways, but, he was on that show for 7, 8 seasons. They had some uneven seasons with him. Eddie was just shot out of a cannon. And the number of characters he came up in his first full season is unprecedented. I mean, he'd 12 running characters in that first full season. I think he's the best cast member they've ever had, personally.
And he pops in a way. I mean, you watch 48 Hours or Beverly Hills Cop and you think, it's just ridiculous. I mean, and his translation to the big screen was probably, although a lot of people have gone on to great things on the big screen, those two show and Trading Places, those three movies alone right after this, and I mean, just incredible.
And I think, Wig was really talented. I personally think a little bit overrated just because you look back at the body of the work and like what the great sketches were with her. And she has less great sketches than you think. Like the beauty in what she did was she was just an unbelievable actress. And I think that was the same quality that Jan Hooks had and that Jan Hooks, never got credit for. Jan Hooks was a great actress. Like you watch some of those sketches and she's just really, really, really good. It's almost like having the sketch comedy version of Meryl Streep or somebody, just selling these crazy, weird characters. And you watch like something like the Sweeney Sisters, and she's just all in 1,000,000%, And I think the women that have succeeded on the show the most, whether it was Wig or Hooks or Molly Shannon or Maya Rudolph, those are they just went all in. They were just fearless. And that was what I respected about Wig. But I look back and I'm like, what were the four best sketches she's ever been in? I don't even know.
But you felt in good hands when she was on.
Always.
I mean, there was, she was on solid ground and you just knew that she could pull it off. She was very, very steady.
Who do you think was the most underrated SNL cast member from the first 40?
On the first 40, it's funny because I was tempted the other day. I thought it was really sad that I mean, obviously the Jan Hooks died, but she never got the acclaim. I'm glad that she got it recently in the past couple of weeks. But in some ways, I might throw her out as number one, because even though she was noticed and people knew her, the degree of her talent and the impact that she had on the show and her presence on the show, I think, is infinitely larger than what she's gotten credit for. So I still consider her to be underrated.
Yeah, she's up there. I would put Gilda number one. I think Gilda.
See, but I never think of Gilda being underrated. I mean, she was a genius, and we thought she was a treasure while we were watching her.
You and I thought that, but I think if you're under 30, I'm not even positive you know who she is.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Unfortunately, she died so young, we didn't get a chance to know her longer. But I think at the time, I mean, if you kind of view it, I'm trying to answer the question in time and, you know.
Oh, in real time. Yeah, that makes sense.
Look, when Gilda was the second or third year, people were saying this is, you know, that generation is Lucille Ball.
Right.
I mean, she was definitely acclaimed. Unfortunately, like a lot of SNL women, she had a harder time leaving the show after, you know, to do what she did afterwards.
Well, yeah, and she had a lot of personal issues too. But I still think she's the most talented female they ever had. Like, she could do the most things, and you just go back. Like, fortunately, all those sketches are on Yahoo for the most part now. Just the variety of looks that she had and how she just owned different sketches was amazing. I think people forget how big and important and awesome Dana Carvey was when he was on that show. You know, it's weird. Hartman has become kind of the guy that people remember first from that era, but that was Carvey's show for the first 4 years they were on together. Remember?
Absolutely. And he did. I mean, like Hader, one of those guys that can kick ass in a sketch, but also the impersonations are fantastic. And that duality, that combination of skills, is pretty rare. Dana Carvey is really up there. And he was so important to the show and, you know, just a great ambassador for the show as well.
I do think I was saying this to my staff when we were trying to figure out who the seeds would be for the tournament, all that stuff. And my only thing, I was becoming grumpy old man on the couch, but I was like, we have to judge these people just by what they did on the show. Like, everybody loves Farley, and Farley had, you know, the Chippendale sketch is one of the best ever, and the Matt Foley sketch is one of the best ever, and he was a force of nature on the show, no question. But people love him because of everything, you know, their memories of him in those couple of sketches, plus Tommy Boy, which became this iconic comedy from that decade. And we have to remember that he got fired from the show. You know,
when you're comparing him
to Will Ferrell and Eddie Murphy, like, those guys never would have been fired from the show ever in a million years.
Well, I think in your grid there, I think Dana actually lost to Chris, and there's just no way, in terms of, if you just view it through their work on the show, Dana Carvey's body of work on SNL was, you know,
unassailable.
Much more impressive than Chris's.
Yeah. I mean, he created multiple running characters that they got in crazy. He had Garth, he had Hans and Franz, and he had Church Lady, which they probably got a combined 50 sketches out of. And then on top of that was awesome in all these other sketches too. But
and Bush.
Oh yeah, and Bush. When you were researching this, or doing the interviews for the last 10 years, was there a theme that popped up that surprised you?
Yeah, I actually thought one of the most interesting things was, I mean, the first 30 years was, you know, I had a healthy dose of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And it was just interesting because the stuff behind the camera and the culture of the place, it's just a huge paradigm shift. I mean, you know, Tina Fey said to me, Jim, we're like worried about making our appointments with our personal trainers.
Right.
I mean, people were not, you know, going to the after party at 3 a.m. A lot of them were either married or in committed relationships. So, you know, the hooking up factor was greatly reduced. You can walk through the offices and, you know, occasionally smell pot, but it's nothing like it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And they were really, really concerned about their careers. They were working really, really hard. They were kind of like, you know, operating between the 40-yard lines. And that was just a total change, which I think was kind of interesting to report on. You know, interview after interview after interview, people would say, I don't think I could have survived on the show back then. How the hell did they get the show out?
Right.
It's such a tough show to do. I don't know how they could do it based on what I heard. And, you know, so it was, that was a real surprise. I had no idea.
Well, imagine doing the show in the 70s without email, or the 80s, or the 90s. Like, when you think of it that way, it's hard to believe they've stuck to the same structure of the schedule, when you would think that email and some of this other stuff would have made it easier. I was surprised. Reading the new stuff, I was really surprised. Jim Downey was kind of throwing grenades, right? He had no problem lobbing
man.
A couple.
He plays for Keith. There's no unspoken thoughts, which is why I love him so much. I mean, he really he says what he thinks. And it's funny because he'll say, I don't think that sketch was particularly well written, but, you know, got a lot of tension. So who knows? I mean, he just goes for it.
It does seem like there's a little bit of a tension, especially with some of those, some of the Hall of Fame writers they've had over the political stuff and who did the better job and what they're doing now. And, you know, I just, as somebody who just loves the show and just loves all the history behind it and all the subtle inner workings and all that stuff, like I really enjoy some of that stuff when they're just kind of floating these little quotes that read between the lines type stuff. But you can totally read between the lines if you have enough background. And there was a lot of that, I thought, in the 200 new pages.
Yeah, and I think, and also there was, you know, both Tina and Amy, in interviews with them, they made it clear that in the kind of old boys network was not something that they were going to put up with when they kind of came to power. And that represented another sea change. Not that I buy into, you know, everything that was said about the earlier years, but it was interesting because you'd always hear that expression, boys club, boys club, boys club, when I was doing the first book. And the second, the new book, you just never heard it. It just wasn't part of the equation the past 10 years. Maybe some people experienced it, but none of the people that I, you know, basically interviewed everybody, and nobody was talking about that there. So that was quite the paradigm shift.
My one quibble with the 200 pages, a lot of Finesse Mitchell and a lot of Horatio Sanz. That was my one nitpick. Just a lot. You just relied on those guys a lot. That's all I'm saying.
Finesse tells a good story, you know, and sometimes it's interesting to talk to the people who are there for a couple of years and just can't make it to six or seven and why that happens, and particularly if they have great starts. I mean, the interesting thing is there's no guarantees on that show. You could, I mean, unless you're an outlier like, you know, Will Ferrell or Sarah Hader or somebody like that with incredible talent, you know, Hader said that Lorne walked up to him pretty early on. He said, you know, you can have this job for as long as you want, which rarely happens.
Yeah.
Which rarely happens in the history of Saturday Night Live. So there are people who get off to these amazing starts and then they wind up falling apart, or they just can't keep up the momentum.
You did a great piece for us on Grantland during SNL week about Lorne Michaels.
Oh, thanks.
And I heard through the grapevine that he actually appreciated it and thought it was well done. But you're trying to capture what it's like for this guy 40 years in. He wasn't involved in all 40. I guess he was involved in 35 of the 40. Just keeping that grind. Somebody explained this to me once, that when people are like, well, when's Lorne leaving? When's he going to give it up? And it's very similar to why it was so hard to get David Stern out of the NBA commissioner's office. I think Lorne's much better than David Stern was near the end. But where once you're not in charge of that show anymore, you're not as relevant anymore. And everyone's not returning every phone call you make. And maybe you're not getting the best table at the restaurant. And there's all these little variables that come with being the guy who runs SNL. It's still one of the most important jobs in media. It's still one of the most influential TV shows we have.
I also think Lorne like actually loves it. I mean, if you go to a show and you watch him in between where the commercials are, he's like watching the details of the set and whispering in the cast members' ears. And he really loves it. I think at this point, I mean, Lord knows he has enough money and he'd still probably get great reservations at restaurants. If he didn't love it, I don't think he'd be doing it. He just can't get enough of it.
Yeah. And it certainly doesn't seem like in Stern's case near the end there, I think he was definitely got a little hostile, and little stubborn in his ways, and there was a paranoia that was in those offices. That none of that stuff seems to be happening even remotely at SNL. It seems like
it's going the opposite way. In fact, yeah. We have a kinder, gentler Lorne. He's much more benevolent and much more. He was always the kind of father figure, even when he was the same age as the cast members. But now he's really the father. And cast member after cast member talked about the fact that he's become much more accessible now than I think there are probably a lot of cast members from previous eras who are very envious of this current crop, that they feel like they can walk in and talk to him about stuff on the show and even their personal lives.
Isn't it amazing that he's probably the most powerful he's ever been? When you think about, like,
well, without a doubt, because of Jimmy and Seth and
right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Sunday night's the only night of the week that there isn't a Lorne Michaels show at the local news.
And also, you could say that the biggest mistake anyone made in late night since Joan Rivers backstabbed Johnny Carson was Conan O'Brien deciding that he didn't need Lorne Michaels for The Tonight Show.
That was a big mistake. Moving to L.A. and, I mean, there's a great quote in the book from Jeff Zucker. I was pretty surprised. I mean, I was glad Jeff said it, but he said, you know, if Lorne had been part of the equation with Conan, things might have turned out differently, and certainly not as dramatic. And you have to believe that would have been the case. That was a wrong calculation on their part.
I don't even think might. I think that's a 100% they would have turned out differently. And I also think Lorne would have talked him out of moving the show to L.A. I think he would have talked him into keeping it into New York so it could remain part of that family. I think he would have fought. The Leno 10 o'clock thing never happens if Lorne's involved. It just doesn't. And that was the thing that I thought undermined Conan's show more than anything. And also, like, wait, when did Lorne officially not get involved? In 2009, or was it earlier than that with the Tonight Show thing?
Well, basically once Conan got it, it became very clear that Lorne was not going to be the executive producer.
Right. Because I'm not sure Lorne would have thought it was a good idea for Conan to wait 5 years until he took over. Just in general, that was the weirdest decisions anyone made, like to wait 5 years. So much can change in 5 years. Conan was hot in 2004. That's when he had all his options, you know?
It's a long time. Hey, listen, as long as I have you, I did, as you mentioned, I did write this other book about ESPN.
Oh, no, you're hijacking my podcast.
It's a sports network in Bristol, Connecticut, and I just feel as a journalist, I wouldn't be, I'd be underserving if I didn't ask you. So we had to postpone the podcast, but how upset were you when you got suspended? Well, listen, I don't want to be a jerk and hijack too much, but just one more little question here.
Well, wait, hold on. We should mention that a lot of this stuff might actually get cut out, so just be prepared.
Oh, good to hear.
Look, I think for the 15-minute ESPN conversation we just had, that maybe 3 minutes will actually make it into the podcast.
Oh, come on.
I think it was pretty illuminating.
You should at least allow me to edit it in the fairness.
I think for us to have a real conversation about this, I think it'll have to. What are you doing the paperback?
Of which book?
Of the ESPN book. When's that happening? When are you doing the next round?
Probably in a couple of years.
Yeah, I'll save all my stories for that. SNL. The book is called Live from New York. It's available in paperback. You can get it on Amazon.
No, hardcover.
It's hardcover? You're right. It is hardcover. You mailed it to me. Yeah. Look how poorly researched I am. It's a hardcover, and it's available on Amazon and the four remaining bookstores in America that still exist. You can get
Actually,
it.
Actually, it's worse than that. It's because it's not really available on Amazon because my publisher has shed is in this ground war in Southeast Asia with Amazon. So they've been screwing around with stuff.
It's not on Amazon?
Well, it is, but then it's not discounted. And they say we'll be available in 3 weeks. I mean, it has just been, there are a lot of people going through it. Malcolm Gladwell sales are down. So I can't take it personally. Everybody's been at Hachette and Little Brown has been suffering because of this, but it is just evil. it's just so different having a book come out and, you know, without Amazon, you know, being part of the equation. It's just brutal.
I've been debating for like the last 4 years whether I wanted to write another book or not. And the book industry is so screwed up.
Just self-publish it.
I guess that's what you'd have to do.
You have the platforms to do it.
Right. It's just to self-publish it and to put the amount of time and you'd have to do to promote it. I don't totally see how it's worth it. And, you know, like when I did the basketball book, it was just push it on Amazon, push it in these three places. Like the world kind of made sense. And
ESPN book on Amazon was a dream. There were 35,000 downloads in the first like 3 hours, 3 days. They featured it all the time. It was great. And it got to number one the first week in Amazon. But this whole saga that's been going on for 6 months is just brutal.
Well, it's a little similar to what's happened with the record companies, right? A friend of mine told me last week, I think the number two, like Taylor Swift's album was a huge hit, but then like number two through number 100 sold something like 1 million copies combined for albums. And it's just gravitating toward this world where people just buy iTunes songs. So now the new model would be, all right, well, I'll just release the songs for I think the Foo Fighters are trying this actually. I'll just release the songs for my album one at a time for $1.29 each. And then after I'm done releasing the songs, then I'll put them all under the album umbrella. But it's like, the point is, they don't know what the hell's going on with that industry. And it feels like the book industry is the same way. I don't know how it plays out. I don't fully understand the landscape. So that makes me not want to write a book.
Yeah, it's brutal.
I would read any of your updated paperbacks, though. Is there a third institution that you'd want to do? ESPN or SNL? Who's
right
third?
Now.
Can you talk about it or no?
When you talk about where you're going to...
Jim Miller, as always, it was a pleasure. I don't know how many minutes this podcast will actually be, but I know we're taping it for almost an hour and I had fun and it was a good time.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
And SNL this week, Chris Rock. So that'll be good. I'm excited for that one. The BS Report will return, I guess, later in the week. We'll have one more. Enjoy the start of the NBA season, everybody. Thanks to Jim Miller. Thanks to everybody behind the scenes. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNradio.com.
Peace out.